Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
Hello, and welcome to Your Family Dog. I'm Julie Fudge-Smith, and I'm here with Colleen Pilar. And today, we're going to talk about dog bites. But first, we'd like to give a shout out to our listener, or maybe perhaps listeners, in Thailand and in Ireland. So we're very excited to have them on board. If you in Thailand or Ireland have any questions, please don't hesitate to send us an email at feedback@yourfamilydogpodcast.com. All right, so dog bites, not something that people want to think about, but how serious are they? How frequent are dog bites? Are they really as frequent as we think they are? So, Colleen, do you have answers to either one of those questions?
Sort of. I have answers to both of those questions, but they're not actually as easy to find as you would think. The Centers for Disease Control says that about 4.6 million dog bites occur each year, and about 2.8 million of them are to kids 13 and under.
Okay.
One particular issue with that is that that was taken from a very small survey based on memory and then extrapolated out to go across the country in terms of, you know, how often is this happening and how frequent is it? And then we also come into to play with it. We're talking about, you know, reported dog bites. There are plenty of dog bites that aren't ever reported. So we're not really sure. The rules have changed,
right,
and the laws have changed so that statistics are becoming a little bit more accurate. But even so, we don't honestly know how many dog bites occur. The good news, though, most dog bites are not serious. Very, very few dog bites are serious in terms of injury. Now, I would say every dog bite is serious in terms of that it is a failure of management and supervision and setting our dogs up for success. So every dog bite is a failure. That if we're looking at our behavior in terms of, is the dog enjoying it, is the dog tolerating it, or is the dog trying to end it? Well, if we're in a dog bite zone, we're totally in the red zone, which means we missed all of our yellow. But when we move past that piece and just sort of look at how serious are they, less than 0.1% of dog bites cause injuries that are rated by medical communities as moderate or serious. So 99.9% of dog bites are either no injury or very, very minor injury that you recover rapidly from. That's pretty good news, I think.
I think that's excellent news, because what it shows is that most of our dogs are really, they're trying to tell us, I don't want to do this. I don't want to hurt you. I just want to have whatever is happening end, and I need some help. And I've been trying to tell you that. So I think that our dogs have tremendous bite inhibition, and that's really good news. Not good for the 0.01% or whatever it is who have a serious dog bite, and that's not to minimize their injuries. But the good news for most of us is that these are not going to be horrendous bites causing a great deal of medical care. It's not to say that they can't be traumatic, especially if it happens to a child. There can be a certain amount of trauma involved, even with a minor bite. So it is something that we want to avoid, because the other thing is who wants to put your dog in that kind of stress? Who wants to have him practice that way of getting people to back off? Because I think we talked about it in one of our podcasts about growling. I think it was the growling one. Mm-hmm. Where if growling fails, right, to warn people that I need you to back off, and we have to escalate to a more serious behavior, it's very difficult to get the growling back.
Right.
So if the dog has escalated to biting, you're right. Something has failed here, and we don't want dogs to practice that behavior, nor do we want them to think that that's the only behavior that's going to get them back to a safe zone.
Right. So I think it's really important to look at that. And when I say failed, I do know that's a really strong word. I am not trying to lay blame on the people who are there in that situation. I'm not trying to do that. But I am trying to say it does mean we miss things, because I believe all dog bites are preventable and avoidable if we know how to set things up for success. And we don't always know that, particularly in the first case, we don't always know. But once a dog has bitten, we should be able to, you know, reverse engineer some of that and say, what went wrong? What can I do differently to learn from this and make sure that this is not going to happen again? Because it is a breakdown of communication. Dogs are social creatures and they want to hang out with us and they want to feel safe just like we do. So
right.
We want to make sure that we're having these communications that are safe. And it's a tough thing because we are really looking at a bite being sort of a method of last resort.
Correct. And it's also tough if you don't have a dog that gives some really clear signals. There are dogs who are very subtle in their signaling. It may mm-hmm. be just a little bit of a low rumble that's barely audible, a bit of a lip curl, and then boom, there's a bite. So it feels like it came out of nowhere, and it feels as if it was totally unprovoked. But my own feeling on dog bites is from the view of the dog, they're never unprovoked. There's always some sort of provocation
Correct.
From the dog's point of view.
From the dog's perspective, right.
And so if you can't figure out what that provocation is, then you're likely to get your dog into that situation again. So it's real important, as you said, to sort of reverse engineer, to take a real close look at where were we, what was going on, what was he doing, what were people doing around him, was there some sort of odd noise or smell or something. It really is worthwhile to try and figure out what the triggers might have been. And the other yes. thing is as we talk about, oh, I don't know, pretty much what, every episode, it's important to begin to really recognize your dog's early stress signals. So,
yes.
You know, does he just start moving, you know, freezing? If a dog freezes, that oftentimes precipitates a bite. But freezing can be, I just slow down my movements. So I start mm-hmm. moving much more slowly. And that could be a really interesting trigger and one that you could say, oh, he started to move really slowly. That may mean that he is trying to slink away from something. He's upset. We need to do something to make him comfortable. So there can be some extraordinarily subtle signs that may just think, oh, God, that's so funny. Look at the way he's moving. No, it's not funny. It's his way of saying, I'm upset here.
Yes. And I think your point about some dogs having very subtle or short signals brings up two different thoughts. The first is that, yes, some dogs are less expressive than others. But in general, I believe dogs wear their hearts on their sleeves and they tell us what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But if a dog is punished or suppressed in any way for showing discomfort, so if, for example, every time my dog is uncomfortable with a person, he growls at him and I fuss about that. Don't you growl at anyone. You better knock that off. Hey, grab his muzzle, whatever. What I've now taught the dog is don't growl. Okay. But I haven't made the dog any happier or more comfortable.
Right.
And so I'm now creating this powder keg where some signals aren't being as clearly communicated because they've been suppressed. That's a huge concern. So we definitely need to use positive reinforcement training for any sort of behavioral issue, because suddenly without warning is not what we want for a dog bite.
Right, right. And I couldn't agree more. And I think we talked a little bit that about in the growling episode as well, that mm-hmm. you can't punish the growl because it's your wonderful early warning system. And it's your dog's way of clearly communicating that something is upsetting to him. And the lack of behavior, which I think we've talked about before,
mm-hmm.
Is not necessarily good behavior. The lack of
right.
behavior may mean I don't know what to do. I'm suppressing
yes.
the behavior I want to let you know, and I can hold this beach ball underwater just so long, and it's
yeah.
going to come out, and it's going to come out with a vengeance. So the lack of behavior is not necessarily a good thing because it means that your dog is losing ability or ways in which to clearly communicate to you.
Right, and that is a tough message for a lot of people to absorb.
Yes.
Because so often when we think of the best trained dogs, we're not imagining their behavior, we're imagining their control. And so in our episode where we were talking about arousal and whether arousal was actually just too much energy or whether it was really friendly behavior, one of the things we talked about was large, loose, and lateral, side-to-side right. kind of movement. So when we're saying that people often perceive bites come from out of the blue, I believe that's true. They do believe that bites come from out of the blue. But some of that comes down to not really being able to recognize our three basic areas of when my dog is enjoying things and when my dog's just tolerating them,
right?
Which would be our green and our yellow, versus when the dog is done. So green and yellow, that's where we start losing our large, loose, and lateral. You know,
yes.
So if we've gone from like happy dog, life is grand, and then we get slower moving and a little bit more tentative and a little more uncomfortable, that's important to see.
It is important
and
to
say, oh, my dog's having a little bit of a tough time with this.
Right. Maybe I need to have that child, you know, back up a few feet. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising. I have a dog that was a client's dog who was a rescue from a hoarding situation. And the dog is very uncomfortable with men, and including the woman's husband. But we've gotten to the point where they can go for a walk as long as the husband stays somewhere between 5 to 10 feet away from them. And when he mm-hmm. does that, you can watch the dog gets kind of loose, and now we're trotting along on our walk, and I'm having a good time. But if the husband gets any closer than 5 feet, the dog just, the tail drops, mm-hmm. the head goes stiff, he just looks out of the corner of his eyes. It's just like a switch was turned in that dog. And right. it was just, to me, I kind of wish I had that on video, because it's such a wonderful mm-hmm. example of what we're talking about. Is for some dogs, they have a really clear bubble around them within which I yes. don't want you to get anywhere near me. And if you are paying attention, you're going to see that exact almost inch where I stop mm-hmm. being comfortable with your approach.
Yes.
And I think also too, one of the things that we've also done with this little dog, and why we were able to get the husband down from 20 feet to 5 feet, is we were really excited by that was the presence of turkey.
Yes.
And the ability for the dog to say, and when the dog started to tense up when the husband was at 15 feet, we had the husband back off. So the, you know, or allowed the dog to move away. So giving him some freedom of movement was one of the ways in which we were able to help him become comfortable within that 5 foot zone. Whether we're going to get past 5 feet or not, I don't know. Stay tuned.
But that sense of choice and control is extremely important. So giving the dog some ability to control the environment and,
yes.
and say, I'd like to be farther away, or I'd like to be closer. I get to choose. It helps in many cases, because some bites occur because a dog feels trapped.
Right.
The dog feels like options have been taken away. Either they're restrained by a leash or some sort of physical environment where they're saying, I'm having a problem, and I can't get myself out of it. I can't make a different choice, or not one that I can think of, because I'm a dog.
Yes.
You know, so they're not exactly coming up with 82 different creative solutions. They're like, move away or growl about this. So that's a very important thing.
Yeah, because the dog's saying is, I can't move away. There's no physical room for me to move. I'm going to have to figure out a way for you to move away. And so mm-hmm. that's why I growl, and that's why I snarl, and that's why I snap at you. Because what I'm trying to say is, give me the distance I can't take. And that's one reason why
right.
when I'm out with clients and they're out walking their dogs, one of the rules which we've talked about, I don't remember which episode, was my rule of two, having two escape routes, making sure that your dog always has a way that you can either move physically or mentally to give that dog an out. And I think that if you have a dog and you're going into a crowded area, you need to be thinking in terms of escape routes, ways in which you can keep your dog safe, because you never know when somebody is just going to come charging up. In fact, I was working with a very sensitive German Shepherd the other day, and we were walking through downtown Granville during the mid-morning. I chose that time in particular because I knew there wouldn't be a lot of people. There'd be a few people. And that's what we wanted, was just having him walk by a few people, sit on a park bench, watch people come by, get turkey, sniff at the bikes and the racks. You know, no moving bikes, just bikes and racks. And he did really well. So I said, you know, we've done really, really well. I think we've made some improvement. Let's head back to the car. And as we stood up, this gentleman came rushing right up to the dog. And I tried to step in front of him and say, I'm sorry, but we're training here. And he said, oh, I just have to pet the dog. And just dove in there and pet the dog. Well, I think the owner and the dog and I were all so startled, we didn't quite know what to do. He petted the dog and moved on. He was really lucky that that dog did not growl or snap at him. And so I think that owners have to be aware that even no matter how careful you can be, there can be people out there who are going to sabotage you, which is why why it's always important to have alternatives for your dog, to have an escape route, to have, you know, a whole bunch of things. So what happened? This guy rushed in, petted the dog, and then I rushed in with, I think it was steak. You know, right afterwards saying, oh, people come and do that to you, you get little steak bits. Isn't that wonderful? So another reason why I always carry treats on walks, because I don't know when I'm going to have interesting individuals come flying at me out of, you know, seemingly out of nowhere, because he really did. He must have come out of the ice cream parlor and just made a beeline for this dog. So.
And that brings up another interesting thought on the whole idea of, over the years, my feelings on the subject of bite prevention have evolved somewhat. And I am now a little bit uncomfortable with that phrase because, first off, I think most people aren't seeking bite prevention for their dog because their brain really doesn't allow them to think that their dog would bite someone.
Right.
So if I show up at your house and I'm like, I have these great bite prevention techniques for you, you're like, my dog is nice. I have a nice dog. I don't need that. And it really focuses just on the danger piece. But the flip side is if we could start really understanding body language. So if your dog is unhappy but not biting, I am not in any way happier than if your dog is unhappy and biting. I'm like, we're still in the situation where we're making your dog miserable.
Right.
In one case, your dog, I mean, certainly I care from a human perspective. Let me clarify that. But if your dog is miserable and non-aggressive, I'm still pretty upset about that. So, oh, yay, we've done bite prevention techniques. Dog isn't biting, but he's still miserable. No. Mm-mm, that's not what we're looking at. What we're looking at is let's understand body language so that we can set our dogs up for success and really help them to thrive by recognizing what this dog likes and what this dog doesn't like. So that's a huge piece for me in understanding dog bites is that, again, they are last ditch efforts. We've gone through our greens and our yellows and we're at the end of our reds when we're getting a bite.
Yes. Because we're at the beginning of the red when we're growling.
Right. And so I think we should be so, so grateful that when these dogs are hitting the red, that the bites really statistically are not bad. I mean, there's this fantastic book called Dogs Bite, but Balloons and Slippers Are More Dangerous. And it is just filled with these crazy charts that talk about how cows are more dangerous than dogs and, you know, more people are injured by all sorts of things, including balloons and slippers.
Yes, slippers.
It's just sort of funny because we do not think of balloons as being an extremely dangerous object, and yet they are more likely to wind up in – you're more likely to wind up in an emergency room as a result of your balloon or your slippers than you are because of having a dog in your life. So I think that's hugely important. So when we're looking at the dog bite statistics and we've got the 92.4% that have no injury at all, where a dog actually bit but there was no injury, yay! Like, wasn't it awful that the dog bit? But when the dog bit – 92.4% of the time there's no injury? That's fantastic. And then an additional 7.5% are like a minor injury. I've got a bruise. I've got a sore hand for a week. I've got some discomfort, but it's totally recoverable and I'm going to be great. And, you know, within a week or 10 days, I'm going to be totally fine. That's 99.9% of dog bites. So that is fantastic. However, that doesn't have anything to do with insurance companies or legal situations. And we are a very litigious society here in the U.S. And that's
a problem. Yes, we are.
So we treat dog bites like they're very dangerous. We treat them like they are, you know, very gross injuries that require a lot of medical care and treatment. That's not true. The costs associated with dog bites are insurance payments.
Costs.
Yeah, not because of your injury, but just because I was bitten, so therefore I've got, you know, to sue you.
Right. And then, unfortunately, the other side of that is all these sort of breed-specific things.
Yes.
Which drive me crazy, that if you may lose your home and owner's insurance if you own a Doberman, mm-hmm. or a Rottweiler, or even a German Shepherd with mm-hmm. some companies. But you know what? Golden Retrievers can bite too, and yet that doesn't affect it. And that really bothers me too, because I feel as if you need to be looking at the individual dog. Now, I don't know if there's anything you can do, like have your dog be a certified canine good citizen, if that will make a difference on your insurance rates. I don't know if most companies are like that, but it shows the degree to which we don't understand.
Many insurance companies.
Okay.
But even within that, I have a little bit of awkward moment there too, because I know some amazing dogs who can't pass the American Kennel Club's Canine Good Citizen test for one reason or another. And one of the parts of the test is a 3-minute separation from the owner while being held by a person who's, you know, trustworthy. So the person can talk to the dog, but you know, there are plenty of dogs where if their person walks out of the room, the dog is going to go, but my friend, come back. And does
yes.
that make your dog a bad dog? Or, you know, your dog pulled a little bit while you were doing the walking exercise, but everything else was great. Does that make your dog a bad dog? Does that mean you shouldn't have homeowner's insurance because your dog pulls sometimes? So I like
right.
the American Kennel Club test. I'm not saying I don't, but I am saying I know some dogs who I think are extraordinary dogs who haven't passed it and are not in any way dangerous. So I
right.
think the breed-specific legislation is an issue, and I think having a test of some sort that we require dogs to pass in order to get insurance is an issue as well, because it kind of takes out that piece of different dogs have different strengths. And
right.
and that's
right.
a reasonable thing.
Yes, I agree. There's no perfect system here, but the I feel that oftentimes these rules are just an overreaction. I remember I was on a little commission here in Granville to take a look at dog leash laws. And in Granville, it had been if your dog is under control. And there was this big push to have dogs have to be on leashes in the village. And one member was trying to push, you know, I think anywhere within a 5,000-mile radius of Granville is what she wanted, a leash law. And I was pushing more for our immediate downtown 3 blocks, because mm-hmm. that is a much more unpredictable place to be. Mm-hmm. And there are our ice cream parlor where everybody in this little village of 3,000, everybody in the summer goes to Witz and gets an ice cream cone. So I can see having your dog on a leash in that area would be a really good idea. So then that's finally what they came down to, was the leash within the immediate downtown area. But one woman was just so upset because somebody had put their dog on a bike rack and run into the CVS to get something and came out. And the dog had barked at a little girl when the mm-hmm. woman was in the CVS. And I said, did anything happen other than the barking? And she said, well, no. I said, so nothing happened. And she said, she barked. I said, dogs do that. I'm thinking to myself, you're kind of barking at me right now, woman. But but it was just, she wanted to push so hard for these leash laws. I'm like, but the dog was leashed up. Nothing happened. He barked simply because the dog startled
right.
a child, which I don't want a dog to startle a child. Please don't get me wrong. But let's get a little perspective here. The owner could have been standing there with the dog and talking to a friend, and the dog could have barked and startled somebody. So
right.
what are you going to do? Start banning dogs completely? And that's just unreasonable as well. So I think that sometimes there's this push to try and mollify those who don't really understand
right.
what the actual danger is.
I think some of that comes back to our primitive brain, where we see a living creature with teeth as really scary and a bicycle as not that dangerous. You know, so, you know, that little girl has probably fallen off her bike. and gotten hurt,
right.
Scraped her knee and got back on her bike and rode it again the next day. And so her mother is not saying, let's not have any bikes in Granville. She's saying, let's learn how to be safe on bikes. Well, when this dog barked, the mother went, oh my gosh, a predator in our neighborhood. And that is a totally legitimate brain response, but completely inaccurate in terms of assessing the danger. So
right.
That's a problem. And we're not really going to be able to rewire people's brains for that. But we do need to recognize it. Like, we are not nearly as afraid of cars as we should be, because cars kill us all the time. And we're like, oh, well,
they
cars.
Do.
but
yeah, they're these big hunks of steel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're dangerous.
Yes.
Especially if they're driven by people who, you know, shouldn't be driving cars.
When we look at... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, when you mentioned that, I found the statistics on the average number of injuries per year that people suffer from bare feet, over 400,000, 423,825, sneakers, 214,646, shoes, how that differs from sneakers, I don't know, but anyway, other shoes, 198,670, slippers, 64,974, dogs, 62,743. Now, the statistic doesn't stipulate if this is dog bites or just injuries involving a dog, like I tripped over the dog and sprained my ankle.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of goes to what we're talking about, putting these things in perspective.
Right.
We are not going to outlaw sneakers in Granville.
Right.
That's just not going to happen.
So when we're looking at putting things in perspective, it would be really great if the insurance companies and the lawyers and everyone actually used an assessment that looked at how dangerous the situation was. And Dr. Ian Dunbar has a bite chart that assesses right. dog bites on an increasing level of severity. And I think this is really important because there's a huge difference between different levels of bite or obnoxious and aggressive behavior, but legally there really isn't a difference. So
right.
in a county right near mine, the dangerous dog statute says any dog who injures a person or basically frightens a person into believing they could be injured. So that includes your dog who barked at the little girl. You know, she was frightened and believed she could be injured, or her mother believed she could be injured. That is equal to rushing out of the house and biting you severely. No, I don't think so. So when we're looking at Dr.
Right.
Dunbar's bite assessment, there's these six levels. And level one is obnoxious or aggressive behavior, but no skin contact by teeth, which is really interesting because that means level one isn't a bite on the bite chart. Level one is a threat of a bite. And that's really important because we do need to recognize bites aren't starting with bites. There's this whole stuff that comes
right.
before bites. But I like having the level one because lots of times we have the cases where someone says, well, he nipped at me, or, you know, well, he would have bitten me,
air snapped.
But I got away from him. Yeah, an air snap or a muzzle punch where a dog just closed mouth kind of whacks at you and you're like, huh, that was...
Yeah, and by the way, those hurt.
Yes.
I have been muzzle punched, and they hurt.
Yeah.
But they don't leave a mark. You're like, what the heck just happened to me?
Mm-hmm.
Or they do, it's a little red mark. But it can be sore.
Yeah. And so it absolutely can and should count on this assessment.
Yes.
So level two is that there is skin contact by the teeth, but no skin punctures. However, there may be nicks less than 1/10 of an inch deep and slight bleeding caused by forward or lateral movement of the teeth against the skin, but no vertical punctures. So it could be that, you know, there's kind of like the scrapes. These are sort of the scrape
right.
bites. Then level three is 1 to 4 punctures from a single bite, with no puncture being deeper than half the length of the dog's canine tooth. So this is a question of intensity. How hard is the dog
right.
biting? The dog is biting hard enough to puncture, but not like really biting. You know, we're only going no more than half the length of the dog's canine tooth. They're not clamping down. That's important.
Right.
So there may be less lacerations in a single direction caused by the victim pulling their hand away, or the owner pulling the dog away, or from gravity. For example, if a little dog jumps up, bites, and then drops to the floor, we would have this kind of scraping wound right there. So that's a level three. Levels 1 to 3 are the levels that respond best to training and behavior modification. And level 3 is the big changeover area. So in level bites, we really need to be looking at what can we do to prevent this dog from rehearsing the aggressive pieces. So level 4 is 1 to 4 punctures from a single bite, with at least one puncture being deeper than half the length of the dog's canine teeth. May also have deep bruising around the wound. For example, the dog held on for a certain number of seconds and bore down, or lacerations in both directions. For example, if the dog held on and shook its head from side to side. So that's level 4. We're looking at, that's pretty serious aggression.
That is a serious bite. And that bruising, the dog has, dogs have really strong jaws, mm-hmm. and to clamp down and hold, I had a dog actually clamp down and hold my hand, didn't cause any puncture. But my hand, it was sore for 10 days. It was, and I couldn't shake hands, and, I mean, it was really painful. So that deep bruising is very, very painful.
Yes, it's very significant. And the fact that it's so uncommon in dog bites tells us how well dogs are regulating their control, because even little dogs can give you a really good bruising bite.
Yeah, it just shows what the level of intensity is. That it doesn't sound in some ways that the lacerations are all that different, a little bit more severe than with level 3, but it's that intensity of holding on and the pressure of that bite means that this is becoming a lot more serious.
Yes. And then level 5 is a multiple bite incident with at least 2 level 4 bites. So it's not like I bit you and then I pause to see if you learned a lesson. It's I bit you and I bit you again and maybe I even bit you again. So there's multiple bites.
Right.
And level 6 is, I'm just going to say, worse, because our podcast has this nice rating that is, I'm worried that if we describe what could be worse than level 5 bites, we might be too gross for the general audience. So let's just say worse.
Much worse.
Much worse.
Much, much worse.
And really, really bad.
I'm really glad you noted that levels 1, 2, and 3 are the ones in which we can really work with these dogs and make a difference. And especially when you get to level 3, this is a serious prognosis.
Yes.
It's not a prognosis that says we can't do anything, but it's one that you have to be serious about bite preventing your dog from practicing it and preventing your dog from having the opportunity to bite again. When you start getting to levels 4, 5, and 6, you are talking about a very dangerous dog.
Yes.
And one that the prognosis for recovery from this and getting him back to the safe zone is not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if your dog has had a level 4 or level 5 bite on more than one occasion.
Yeah.
I'm not sure most people have the resources to manage dogs in those situations.
Right. I agree.
It becomes a nearly impossible task.
So this is a reason why we need to intervene really early when we see any signs of our dogs being in the red zone. You know, like if your dog is in the red zone, in any sense of the word, get a good positive reinforcement trainer involved. Even if that just means your dog is continually walking out of the room when something happens. That means my dog is saying, I can't do this, I have to go. Well, let's get a trainer involved and see if we can find ways to make that better so that we can have our dogs not being into the red zone. It matters a lot. One of the issues that comes up frequently is young dogs will display obnoxious or aggressive behavior, and then people will tell me, oh, I'm hoping he's going to grow out of that. No, he's not going to grow out of it. He's going to grow into it. So dogs grow into aggression. That's hugely important. So, and then a final piece that I haven't mentioned that's crossing my mind now, it's occurring to me, is that when we're talking about some of these serious dog bites, the 4, 5, 6s, in most cases, not all, but in most cases, these are not family dogs. It's really important to know. We talk about family dogs, but the reality is a family dog is a companion animal that lives in your home. And then there are resident dogs or dogs on the property. So the dog that just lives near your house or in your yard or in your garage or any of that, that dog is far more likely to bite.
Yes.
So being aware of that and making a distinction both for your own personal safety and for your best care of the animals that you're responsible for, having a dog that just lives in your backyard is not the optimal way of caring for a pet. So we do want safe, happy animals who live in our homes and are enhancing our lives.
Right. Well, Colleen, I think that's a really terrific thing to mention as well. I think it's important to note the difference between a resident dog and a companion animal. I think that we will also put up on the show notes for this Dr. Dunbar's dog bite scale. I've used it with clients and have found it to be a very effective way to bring home the seriousness of what's going on with your dog. And I have several blogs on dog bites, and I know that you have a whole section, once again, on the yellow or green, yellow, and red zones of dog behavior, as well as other bite prevention, although we're trying not to use that word anymore, bite information, shall we say, on your website. So we'll make sure that people have access to all that as well. So I think that that pretty much wraps it up for this week. Colleen, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I think I just want to wrap back around to the piece of vet. We never, ever, ever want your dog to bite.
Right.
But please recognize that if your dog does bite, the odds are really good that it's not going to be physically that damaging to the victim, whether that's a human or another dog, but that it definitely means you should get a dog trainer involved to help you prevent this from happening again, because it does mean that we've missed stuff. So there's that. So yay dogs, 99.9% of the time, they don't really hurt us. That's amazing and fantastic, and they should be celebrated for that. That's the big piece we need to keep in mind. And then we'll do what we can to prevent that other 0.1% from ever occurring.
Right. I know what I was going to say in addition to that, too, is going back to the whole puppy thing. If your puppy's showing obnoxious, aggressive behavior, mm-hmm. that's different than growling during play. And if you're having a difficult time understanding the difference between I'm playing and growling and with my sibling, and I may not be playing growling, get a trainer in to take a look, and they'll be able to help you decide whether or not this is something that is a serious issue that needs to be taken care of. But yes, yay dogs. They really are amazing animals. Colleen, I will see you next week.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.